I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is The Life of a Song, a monthly music podcast from the FT. In each episode, we explore the biography of a different song, its origins, cover versions, how it's evolved over time. But today, we're looking at various songs and albums all released 50 years ago in 1968. What happened in music that year, and why was it so important? I'm David Cheel. I edit the Life of a Song series, published in the Weekend FT and online every week. I'm joined in the studio by the writer and curator Tot Taylor, who published his debut novel, The Story of John Knightley, last year.
Hello.
I'm also joined by Peter Aspden, who writes about pop and much else for the FT.
Hi, David.
So, 1968, it's the year after the Summer of Love, it's the year before Woodstock, but it seems to be a sort of a transitional year in some ways. Peter, what are your feelings about the year? Does it have a theme? Is there a mood?
The mood is one of things falling apart, breaking up. I think what you say about it following 1967 is really important. 67 gets massively hyped as this extraordinary feel-good, hippy-dippy occasion. And even in 67 itself, you get the first signs of a kind of cynicism towards that. Mm. Two things which are created in 67 but actually achieve wider public resonance in 1968. One is Frank Zappa and The Mother's Invention, We're Only In It for the Money, which really rips apart the hippie scene, makes fun of it in the most scabrous way.
Zappa always hated hippies, didn't
absolutely.
He?
Also, rather contrasting from that, the great Joan Didion writes the essay Slouching Towards Bethlehem, where she lives with the hippies and writes this really disturbing account of what it's like, a world that's fracturing.
And Tot, a lot of your novel, the Story of John Knightley, is rooted in the 60s, and 68 is a particular year in the story. Why did you choose that year and that era?
I chose the era because the period between, say, 65, which I think is the kickoff point for pop music, and 1973 is the point at which you get a development. You almost on a weekly basis, songwriting is improving, record production is improving, and music artists' ideas are coming at you. Obviously, with the Beatles, Jimmy Webb, Burt Bacharach, they're all kind of trying to get to the next stage. And I think that 1968 is a sort of watershed year. See Emily Play has been, and White Shade of Pale has been, and we're coming up to MacArthur Park, and we're coming up to Eloise, and we're coming up to the introduction of where classical music or modern classical music meets pop music for the first time with bands like The Nice. And there's a sense of things being sort of what we might call purely conceptual.
Sure. It was an interesting year for English music in particular. So I thought we could have a listen to... This is the first album from a group called Tyrannosaurus Rex, who obviously went on to become T-Rex, and this is Deborah.
Deborah, you look like a stallion. Oh, Deborah, you look like a stallion. You sound from faces like a galleon. Told the mysteries of a Spanish man. Oh, Deborah, da 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 da.
There we have... the young Mark Bolan, the kind of hippie kid. What are your impressions of that, Tot?
I love it. It's kind of what we might call watch with mother vocals, I'd say. You've got sort of Ravi Shankar's influence in the background with these tablas going on. Mm. It's a very musical voice and a very musical concept.
I remember, I'm slightly younger than Tot. I was 10 and I was at primary school when 10 in 1968, and I had a friend who had a very, very hip older sister, and he used to come in and talk about these exotic things, one of which was this group Tyrannosaurus Rex. And, of course, this captured my 10-year-old's imagination hugely. And I listened to the songs. I can't honestly say I liked them very much. They sounded very weird to me. But I remember very clearly in 1970 when T-Rex, the evolved band, brought out Ride a White Swan and they appeared on Top of the Pops. I, at the great wise age of 12, declaring that actually I much preferred their early acoustic stuff.
Yeah, I think I remember doing the same thing, hearing, getting to know T-Rex, but then, as a lot of music fans do, working backwards and discovering that they were almost not unrecognisable, but there's a huge difference. This sort of, in a short period, they went from being, you know, hippie child, elfin child, to glam rock. It was a remarkable change.
But of course, this, the rapid mutation of bands, the Beatles being exemplary in this sense, was something that was quite common, actually. This taking on new musical styles, and Bowie, of course, takes it to yet another level.
Yeah. Next up, The Small Faces released what was possibly one of the first ever concept albums in a remarkable packaging, Ogden's Nut Gone Flake, which was released to begin with in what was essentially a huge tobacco tin. And this was a sort of story with Stanley Unwin's gibberish narrative, and included the classic Lazy Sunday.
I've got no time to worry. Close my eyes and drift away.
This is interesting because you've got these kind of mod kids, but it's mod meets hippie meets psychedelia.
It's a fantastic song and so English. I mean, archetypally, you get this lovely psychedelic effect, which sort of takes you out of it, but yet it's rooted in these great lyrics. You know, wouldn't it be nice to get on with your neighbour?
Mustn't grumble.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that extraordinary combination, which was so appealing, really.
Yeah.
I like the idea that it's got this sort of English music hall thing about it, as in, say, the Kinks or whatever, and some of the Beatles music as well. I love music that's always referring back through stages to previous music, not ashamed to do that. Yeah. They're not trying to sort of get away from anything. They're trying to celebrate where they feel they are. Beautiful one-off.
Which you get in
one-off
early record. Pink Floyd as well. Like, you
know, yeah, early Pink Floyd, of course, yeah. Emily Blunt is the epic example. Yeah.
And again, like Bolan, this was a band who went on to become Rod Stewart's backing band in a pretty short space of time. So you've got transitions happening very quickly.
Yeah,
no. You mentioned Pink Floyd, Tot. This was an important year for them, because it was the year of A Saucer Full of Secrets. And one of the particular tracks from that set the controls for The Heart of the Sun.
Breaking the darkness, waking the grapevine.
So here we are, Pink Floyd. Sid Barrett is on his way out. David Gilmour has joined. This was a big year for them, wasn't it, Peter?
Yeah, it was, absolutely. And seeing the recent show at the Victoria and Albert Museum, which I thought was fantastic, that's Floyd at their most experimental. That's music to just kind of what would now call chill out. That was certainly not a phrase back then. almost certainly take some kind of drug with. Open-ended, could go anywhere, spacey, which turns into in the 1970s to their most successful music with Dark Side of the Moon, etc., which I personally already began to find a little bit ponderous and a little bit boring. But there's no doubt that was a hugely influential period for them.
I find this particularly track fairly boring, actually. I mean, it's a drone. In a sense, it's the opposite of what was actually happening. So what was happening during this 2 or 3 year period, and particularly in 1968, is the expansion of harmony. That's really what it is. You get more and more and more and more chords, more and more orchestras. This could be the blueprint. Just came into my head right now for Riders on a Storm. Sounds like that kind of. It's sort of, they're already doom laden, whereas the Sid Barrett records were sort of childlike. They were doom laden as well. They were sort of frightening but eccentric. This is not eccentric anymore. Yeah. I don't think,
this is one of the things about 68 is that it's actually all happening, isn't
yeah.
it? It's such an eclectic, as I said, experimental year that you have the tautest of beautiful pop songs and you have the most self-indulgent, long and rather boring, as you say, it's quite difficult to sit through these days. It's all happening. It's an extraordinary melting pot. I mean, to use a cliche, but it's very, very difficult to put your finger on any one thing. In fact, it would be wrong.
You have got the singer-songwriter thing, though, which is a new thing, you know, getting rid of the performer. And the songwriter now is the performer, whether they can sing or not. You know, people in bands are starting to think of themselves less than one part of a band, but as four singer-songwriters in a band, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash, whatever. I feel a bit of the, you know, and you feel competition within the bands is coming in as well.
And Dylan must have
been. Dylan,
who has an incredibly quiet 1968, by the way.
Yes.
No albums. He's still kind of recuperating, get his country act together in Nashville and things. But yeah, I mean, all those people, I think, were inspired. I mean, certainly Lennon was, you know, thinking, okay, if I can do that and sit with an acoustic guitar and write my own songs.
Yeah. Talking of which, I mean, all of the examples we've heard of so far have been very English sounding. Across the Atlantic, the singer-songwriter thing was kind of taking off with the first album from Joni Mitchell. And we're going to listen to her song, I Had a King. So Joni Mitchell had been around on the folk scene for a few years, but Song to a Seagull was her first album in 1968. And it's a sort of classic singer-songwriter album, isn't it, Tot?
Yeah, I mean, this song, if you can find on YouTube these days, you know, you can see her in, say, 1965 in this kind of hootenanny kind of style. Here she's using part of Both Sides Now. She's using the bit just before the bridge. You know, she's reusing that, which a lot of songwriters do. And that's part of folk music as well. This turned into jazz, essentially. It turned into sort of modern jazz.
Very personal lyrics, Peter.
Yeah, I love Joni Mitchell. I don't think the early stuff is the best stuff, but I think already you can see really her transcending those folk music roots, which talked about very, very quickly, and a lyrical and musical sophistication. You know, she famously used kind of quite strange open tunings, and that evolves from 68 to, well, in less than 10 years to Hijira, first Hissing of Summer Lawns, Hijira, Mingus, very jazzy. That's an extraordinarily fast and sophisticated and, I think, brilliant musical evolution.
So, again, we're into sort of things changing very quickly, evolving very, very quickly. So, in the meantime, the White Album, it's almost like in a category by itself, isn't it? An extraordinary piece of work from the Beatles, which came out, quite late in the year. Tot, you've chosen a song from this, Martha, My Dear.
When you find yourself in the thick of it, help yourself to a bit of what is all around you. Silly girl, take a good look around.
So, Tot, from the sprawling, epic, magnificent masterpiece that is the White Album, why did you choose this particular song?
Okay, well, I chose Martha, My Dear because it's so underrated and overlooked. It's difficult to say that about any Beatles record, but this one is. The White Album was issued on the 22nd of November. In fact, Beatles records were always timed to come out for Christmas presents as well as anything else. The White Album was the first record I ever bought, sponsored by my parents. I trucked down to the local post office where they always sold just 10 records on the morning of release, and they were looking for it. They couldn't find it because they were looking for a picture of the mop tops on it, and they found this thing which said the Beatles on it and gave it to me. The sleeve designed by Richard Hamilton, of course. I took it home, and as I took the thing out of the package, I assumed that the sliced apple, the white side apple, was side one. So I put it on. I put the needle down on the thing, and I heard these crushed sort of Debussy-esque chords, as I know them to be now. And it's just entranced me so much, I was kind of levitating in my parents' front room. And I picked the needle up again, it hadn't got to the vocal yet, and put it back to the crushed chords. And I must have done that about four or five times. I'd never heard a sound like this kind of piano thing. I mean, it's Debussy or maybe Poulenc or something meets Russ Conway. That's really, really what it is. But this song and John's epic sort of self-deprecating revolution illustrate the sort of opposing personalities of the group. So you have Paul's very upbeat, let's get on with it, cool, against John's more cynical, do we really have to, sort of response. But they both carry on creating equally great songs. Martha's a kind of vaudeville thing. It's one of the Beatles' pastiche or parody songs. I can also hear Fred Astaire in there. I can hear Noel Coward in there. It's very up, very eloquent lyrics as well. Very beautiful
it's
lyrics.
It's about a sheepdog, I think. Is that right, Peter?
Yeah, it's about his sheepdog, which, you know, is the thing with McCartney. You know, you always want to say throw away. You also, oh, it's a sheepdog. It's a little ditty he just sat down. But the sophistication is, as Todd just said,
the changes of pace, the changes of tempo.
Amazing. I had such a similar experience with the White Album. As I said, I was 10 in 68. I had been into Beatlemania since I was 5. I know that sounds ridiculous, but Beatlemania was such a thing, and the songs were so accessible that a 5 or 6 year old could happily join in with them.
You didn't have a plastic wig, did you?
I did have a plastic wig and a little ukulele, which I called my Beatles guitar. I did have a plastic wig, yeah. And I remember very clearly asking my parents to buy me the White Album for Christmas. It was quite expensive.
It was a double album.
But they said, oh, well, okay. And I said to my mum, look, it's white. It's just white. She said, what do you mean? My kind of Greek, very unhip mother, you know, said, well, what do you mean? White? Why just white? You know, I said, look, it's just white. There's no picture of them, you know. Anyway, and I think the important point here, as it relates to 68, sitting down and listening to this extraordinary assembly of things, some which I loved instantly, like Martha, My Dear, and others which absolutely confused me, but it kind of made me want to understand them. You know, why don't we do it in the road? I had no idea what that was about, but that period, it was a period of experimentation which made people want to kind of engage with it.
I used to listen to it obsessively, I think a little bit later than you when I got to it. But yes, I used to just listen to the whole thing through again and again and again, because there's so much depth and variety and strangeness in there. So 68 was a pretty tumultuous year for politics, social upheaval, student riots, protests, assassinations. And yet, strangely, not much of this seems to come through in the music. The Rolling Stones' Street Fighting Man on the Beggar's Banquet album came out that year. But do you think the music reflected this year, Peter?
Some of it did. I mean, again, I think there's a relationship between the experimental nature of the music and the radicalism on the streets. And I think if you were of an age, I think you really did think that you were able to sort of change the world, and you were inspired by this spirit of breaking down walls and pushing boundaries forward. Revolution, the Beatles song, the John Lennon song, is an interesting case in point. Todd, you described it as self-deprecating, which it is. It has self-deprecation in it. You're not really sure. For me, I'm not really sure what Lennon thinks about this. Talk about destruction. Don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's coming, please? So in In the version of Revolution which we just listened to, which is the slow version, we get Lennon prevaricating on a really important line. If you're going to talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out in? He actually sings out in, out slash in, leaving us to wonder, well, actually, whose side are you on, Lennon?
Yes, he got quite a hard time from.
He did indeed, and I think it quite accurately reflected his own state of mind, because there were violent revolutionaries around there, and there was still enough of the peace-loving hippie vibe, and those were so at conflict with each other, and Lennon had a little bit of both in them, I think.
Maybe like Dylan, he didn't want to be a spokesman for a generation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, the singer-songwriter thing was still in full flow, and a young singer-writer called Tim Buckley was starting out. Peter, you've chosen Song to the Siren.
Yeah, well, Tim Buckley was a remarkable, sui generis singer-songwriter, I think. It took a very long time for people to catch up with him, I think. I've actually chosen a moment. There was a programme called The Monkees, which we all remember well, which was a kind of very wacky, anarchic, crazy program about a fictional band called The Monkees. Well, how fictional they were is open to discussion. Loosely based on the Beatles antics in the Richard Lester films. Very surreal. But of course, as it grew up and The Monkees themselves grew up and the 60s grew up, it changed and it became less comedic, and they wanted to make serious points. And they used to have guest appearances. And in the very last episode, right at the end of the episode, when it's finished, a disembodied voice says, ladies and gentlemen, Tim Buckley. And Tim Buckley appears and sings this song to the Siren, on a 12-string acoustic guitar. It's a very, very beautiful song and a lovely performance of it. And really, it's a testament to the mood of introspection. That was another mood, I think, of 1968. There was so much going on that I think the singer-songwriter was sort of people drawing into themselves a bit as the end of that idea of collectivism and really exploring their own feelings in the way that romantic poets did. Buckley did it beautifully.
Did I dream you dreamed about me? Were you here when I was fox, but now my foolish boat is leaning.
Broken. Todd, there's something very beautiful about the way Tim Buckley sings that song, delivers the lyrics.
It's otherworldly. It's this thing where you can't quite understand what the plan is, and you shouldn't try to. He's kind of out of his head in one sense. I don't mean drug-wise, I mean musically. It's just a very individual kind of cloud up there. It's very, very American. I can't imagine a sort of a British songwriter coming up with that.
And it took a while before Tim Buckley recorded it. I think he was unhappy with this, a bit of the lyrics where he says, "I'm as puzzled as the oyster." And I think eventually they changed it to "I'm as puzzled as a newborn child," which he was a lot happier with.
Yes, it's a better line, I think. I think we all agree on that.
Yes. There seems to be something kind of almost classical about the way Tim Buckley's singing that. It's a very calm and...
It's very elegant. The lines are laid out in a poetic way.
Buckley was also one of these people who really progressed very fast and into quite obscure areas. I mean, he was not a popular figure, you know, and by the time we get to his records in the 70s...
They're very experimental.
They're very experimental and hard to listen to. And, you know, this is another great thing about that time, which was there weren't, or there may have been, record company executives tapping on the shoulder saying, look, we need to sell some units here. But if there were, he ignored them and they let him get on with it.
Yeah, they did. There was a lot more money around. The actual business was in an early phase. Nobody really understood what was happening. They'd never expected to be selling millions of something. Mm-hmm. So that was unusual. And I think one weird thing about the whole 1968 period is the idea of this sort of conceptual way of looking at pop music. You know, pop music isn't going to be throwaway anymore. It's going to be significant.
Do you think that people, the musicians themselves, the artists themselves, are beginning to realise that actually this is something that I'm going to do for the rest of my life, which perhaps they didn't start off thinking?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think when you're in 1963, 4, 5, musicians are thinking maybe we're going to open some hairdressers, which was Ringo's solution to the thing, you know, when it ended. But it wasn't going to end. And you're in a business that you didn't really understand, or they didn't understand. It's like the film, industry in America in, you know, 1920 or something, making shorts. Probably nobody really understood that you could make a 3-hour film. And we're now into our 3-hour films. And I think it's the, also important, the influence of art onto pop music or onto music in general, particularly contemporary art, which is new as well. It's interesting that pop music and its newness and its appearance coincides with the appearance of the contemporary art world. And then you have Yoko Ono from Fluxus making a sort of interaction with the Beatles.
And yet those contemporary artists did not become known in the way that the musicians did. I mean, they were very much sort of relying on the musicians to commission their things, but they weren't Damien Hirst, were they? They weren't household name. I mean, no one knew what Fluxus was. I mean, unless you were very sophisticated.
No, that hadn't happened yet. But the Warhol thing was happening. Yeah. So after Picasso, you see Warhol as the first sort of modern person, and that's a mix of mixing the personality in with what they create. And this is important about the White Album and this introspective thing, that pop music becomes very, very personal. You're adding a big slice of your personality. And this is one of the key factors in the music of the Beatles, I think. I think it's why it's so uniquely attractive. It's that we sort of love their personalities as well.
I think the Lennon-McCartney thing, maybe we've all got a bit of Lennon and a bit of McCartney within us. So that sort of duality. So I think that's why maybe we like them both. And also, Peter, you were saying earlier on about the sort of cynicism that was creeping in. Is there a sense in which 68 was kind of the beginning of the end of the 60s?
Yes, I think there is. Look, 68, you know, we can all sit here and talk about these lovely things that happened in 68. It was a pretty horrible year, and in America especially, a very violent year. We had the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. Politics took a very peculiar turn. The Democratic Convention in Chicago, which Norman Mailer wrote about so beautifully in Miami and the Siege of Chicago, It seemed a very bewildering time. I think very, very much you get the sense of the end of this idealistic era and why there is this need to experiment in other directions. It certainly wasn't a naive time. And Bobby Kennedy, you know, he was kind of a rock star himself, wasn't he? I mean, that was such an interesting and tragic story. I'm going to refer to another YouTube clip, which I regard as absolutely essential, which is Bobby Kennedy's reaction to Martin Luther King's death, where he turns up at a rally in Indianapolis, and a lot of the audience, largely black audience, hasn't yet heard about the assassination, and Kennedy has to break the news to him. And of course, being Bobby Kennedy, he comes out with a quotation from Aeschylus, a very beautiful quotation. Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop to drop upon the heart, until in our own despair against our will comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. And one really can't help thinking about the current president of the United States and thinking America sort of travelled a very long way in the 50 years since that.
Yeah. Well, music travelled a very long way in a very short time in 1968. So I think that's about time to wrap it up. So thank you to my guests, Tots Taylor and Peter Aspden. You can read previous pieces by Peter and me and other writers in a new book, The Life of a Song, The Fascinating Stories Behind 50 of the World's Best Loved Songs, which is published by Brewers. And we'll be back next month with another episode.
Oh, my heart. Oh, my heart. Is waiting.